Welcome to Cardboard Philosophy, the board game podcast where we talk about nothing serious, seriously. Each episode, we randomly pick from a list of niche, deep board game topics and have at it. So we invite you to join us at the table, listen in on our conversations, and let us know what you think.
Welcome back, everyone, to episode 30 of Cardboard Philosophy. Nice even 30. We're back here with Evan and Robert. What's good, guys?
We almost have one episode for every year I've been alive.
Wow.
Ooh. For all my fingers and toes, and then my fingers again.
Yep.
All right, so let's see what we're talking about. And we got a 5. And so this is an early one. Let's see. How much do non-game factors affect how we enjoy a game? And this is a Robert topic.
It's been a year, maybe more since I wrote this, so I need to read my notes and refresh. But the idea is sometimes when I play a game, I'm assuming when anybody plays a game, there are factors outside of the game's rules, themes, etc., that can affect how much we enjoy it. For example, you could be having a bad day. You could be playing with somebody who doesn't enjoy that style of game. You could be getting interrupted consistently. What time of day you're playing it, where you're playing it, a noisy place, a quiet place. Some games require more kind of atmosphere to be set than others, but I think every game can be affected by non-game factors. Just general discussion about, have there been any specific examples of this in your lives? Or like, do you make sure that one non-game factor is always a specific way before you play a game? Whatever, just have at it.
There is one specific non-game factor that always affects the length of a game. They are a small factor. They have two legs. They are called children. And oh my goodness, will they inflate the length of a game by anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour and a half. I don't have any of those small factors, but I have a lot of friends that I play games with that do have those small factors running around. And it's always interesting to do a post-game discussion with a friend that has kids, because the conversation will usually be like, well, it was fun. I liked the game, but it was kind of long. And it's like, yes, but we also had to break to feed the baby, and we also had to break to change the baby's diaper. And then your other toddler came out and decided that it thought the first player marker would be a great thing to just grab off the table and run away with. And that can kind of skew your perception of the length of a game, because you have all these factors, which is apparent. It's just a normal thing. But for a non-parent, it's like, oh, we're now going to take a 20-minute break because the baby swallowed a vital component and we have to figure out how to get it out of the esophagus now.
I mean, the classic one, I think, is right, like learning. Like the first time you play, you got to learn the rules. You got to teach it. Like if everybody's new to it, everybody has to be thinking about it, versus if you know the game. That's more of a classic game factor, right? Like that's just part of learning any game. Like after your first play, you got to be like, okay, how much quicker do we think that would go now a second time, now that we all know what's going on?
I have a recent example of this. I recently played some games in a genre I don't tend to like, which is a deck builder. I played two deck builders back to back a few nights ago, but they're with a friend who likes them a lot. And one of the deck builders, The Quest for El Dorado, just to get our first ding of the episode in, I gave it to him as a gift a while ago, and we rarely do game night at his house, because usually it's at my house. I have all the games, but we went there and he's like, oh, hey, I still have that game you gave me, but I don't know how to play it. I was like, oh, I'll teach you. And so even though I don't like that game much at all, nor do I like the genre it's in, I still enjoyed it more than I otherwise would have if I had just like chosen to play it on my own, because I was introducing something to somebody knowing they were going to like it. And so my attitude was totally different. I was kind of seeing it through their lens of like, oh yeah, this person likes it. And every time I mentioned a rule, they'd be like, ooh, interesting. And I'm like, I don't know how that's interesting to you, but I'm happy that you find it interesting. And they seemed to have fun with it. And then at the end, they had another game that they could teach their, you know, family and friends now, since they're comfortable with it. That non-game factor, like the person I was playing with, enjoying the style of game, made me like Quest for El Dorado more than if I were just playing it on my own or with my wife or, you know, out of my own accord.
Robert, you brought this up earlier, like in an earlier episode, about like the kind of group think of a game, you know, like if everybody's enjoying a game, like it's kind of rare that like one person is just having the time of their lives and everybody else is just kind of like, I don't know, it's fine, you know, like you all kind of affect each other a bit, you know,
right?
And I think that's totally true. Like I have a friend like that who like loves, like I met him playing like a collectible card game, you know, like he loves like two-player head-to-head duel-y kind of games like that. And so like I play those games with him all the time and he loves them. And it's like, even when they're kind of crappy, like we have a great time just trying to figure them out, seeing what works, what doesn't. Like, you know, it's just, it's a very, still an intimate thing. They're all two-player games. And so we're always just kind of sitting there talking and seeing what happens. Or just the other day, you know, we had a game day, Robert, and we were trying out some games. And it was funny because I was looking at like your kind of like scores of the games. And I was like, man, I feel like we didn't really play any bangers other than like the first one. But like, it was still a lot of fun to try out these games, see what worked, see what did, you know, like kind of like talk about them, discuss mm-hmm. them. It's like, I still had a really good time just hanging out with good friends, mm-hmm. you know, trying stuff out. Talking about it. I don't know. But then there's stuff like loud people around you that can totally, you know, like there's been times where we are playing in a game store and there's like somebody just having a discussion next to you. And it's like really hard to kind of block that out or not kind of listen when somebody's just talking right next to you, you know? So there's totally those that are hard to completely avoid. You know, it's nice when you can just have your own quiet space.
For me, the people are the most important thing. Like mm-hmm. I could be playing my favorite game of all time. And if somebody doesn't like it, I'll not be having mm-hmm. a great time. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's the most important non-game factor by far. Or I could be playing a game that I really like. Maybe somebody's not having a bad time, but like somebody's not into it.
Yeah.
You can tell they're just going along for your sake. I'm just like, I'd rather stop. I don't know. Like to me, it's all about the people. So the people are really, they're almost more important than the game itself in many respects.
Yeah, the game is just facilitating everybody having a good time together, right?
Yeah. Like,
as the rules explainer, a loud environment can be a little bit of a problem because you want to make sure everyone's internalizing and hearing what you're saying because you don't want it to be like, oh, remember those things I mentioned at the start of the teach where that guy was yelling? Well, all those are where you're getting your points from. I'm sorry. But I think as a player, I kind of like that loud environment because it's very chaotic and fun just to be in the middle of that. Like you can hear other people enjoying themselves and it just kind of adds to that vibe. I probably would enjoy something a little bit more than I normally would in that sort of situation.
I could see like a lively bar adding to the, you know, like a bidding game or something a little bit, you know, like just, yeah, I see what you mean.
I've heard people discuss this before as like, what is the perfect environment, which is obviously very personal to each individual. But does temperature have an effect on this? Like if everyone's really cold or really hot, does that affect your enjoyment of a game?
Totally.
Well, people, this is like a well-documented thing. I don't remember exactly what like the subject is called that documents this stuff, but like when it's hotter outside, people tend to be more violent or angrier. Like throughout history, it's just like civil wars tend to happen when like in the hotter days and the hotter months of the year. Or drivers are just generally angry when it's hotter. So yeah, I bet like if it is hotter, people might be more on edge or like it may be like playing a negotiation or cutthroat game like is a little bit different than when it's not so hot. But it's not something I ever think about consciously though. Like, oh man, it's too cold to play a game today. That's never a thought that I've ever had.
The furnace is broken though and you live in Canada. So it's minus 10 degrees inside and you're thinking, should I really be playing a game or just curl up on the couch under blankets so I keep my body heat?
I know another big one is like music, right? Like some people find music kind of distracting. They like a, you know, their ideal game state would be a nice quiet room. Whereas, you know, like I have one friend in particular who like one of his favorite parts is like finding a good YouTube playlist or something to like set the mood, you know, like, oh, we're playing a game. Okay. I got to find some jazzy music. Cause this game's set in the '20s, you know, like, or, we're gangsters, you know? Yeah. Like again, like some jazzy tunes or something like, I find that to be a lot of fun. It adds just kind of another layer.
Does the intensity of the thematics of the game need to be at a certain threshold for that to work? Like if you're playing Quest for El Dorado, since we've already talked about that, do you just like throw on the Indiana Jones soundtrack? Because it's a little abstracted in that. Or could you just put on like old timey swing music and it kind of has the same sort of vibe, or like jungle music?
I think all of that would work. I would probably just go straight to the Indiana Jones soundtrack. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely times where we play like, you know, pretty themeless trick takers and we're just kind of like, I guess just, you know, pop or something, or like thinking music, you know, like some instrumentals or something. I don't know.
I put on like medieval war music whenever I play chess personally. Yeah.
And this is kind of going to get into a little bit of the first impressions conversation, but we've talked about going into an experience with a preconceived notion in the past and that kind of coloring the experience. I'm wondering if this is a game you've played a lot before and you leave that game feeling, like it didn't really land. Is that a result of some of these external factors hitting, or is it just you're seeing a different side of the game?
I feel like a game could definitely lean, like lend itself to different problems. Like, I'm trying to think of a clear example, but just like party games allow sometimes for people to even like come and go or whatever, mm-hmm. you know? So like having somebody just like randomly, oh, I got to go like get the baby or something, like, oh, you can just drop out for a round or two. That's fine. Those games kind of lend themselves to not have that problem, right? Whereas most board games, it's like for you to just step away for 10 minutes would kind of be a problem. Not to say that that's like a fault of the game or like every designer should plan for that, but it just kind of like there are certain games that inherently lend themselves to some of the problems that external factors can cause. So yeah, I think to some degree you would be seeing like a different side of the game if like you had always played it online and now you're playing it in person. It's like, mm-hmm. that is part of the game, is that's, it's gonna be like that, you know? So it would be seeing a different side of it for sure.
There's often, I think, like the right spirit to play a game in, or the right like vibe to have while playing a game. And if somebody approaches it with the wrong vibe, that can really mess things up. So maybe like, you know, this hasn't actually happened, but like I play Terra Mystica, for example, fairly casually for the kind of game it is. And I think maybe that's why I enjoy it, because I don't think about it too much. And the people I play with don't tend to think about it too much. It's still thinky, but I'm imagining playing it with like an expert Terra Mystica player who like thinks about it a lot and very carefully. Yeah. I don't think I would have as much fun. I would be like, oh, this game is closer to chess than I thought. And I don't like chess and I don't want to just play Euro chess. Because there's like literally no luck in it. And I think you could totally like have opening moves and all that stuff in Terra Mystica. But if you played a bit more loosey-goosey, you open yourselves up to mistakes. Those mistakes are kind of like the luck in the game. Then it's more fun for me. So I can definitely see like how somebody playing it, not wrong, but differently, or like with a different spirit than I tend to play a game, could make me like the game less. I might realize some things about it that I didn't see before.
I've definitely had that happen where like I play a game with one person, we get it, we are like feeling it, and then I go play with somebody else and, you know, it's like, ah, didn't hit as much. And it kind of, sometimes it's like, okay, it's just not for them, that's fine, I still enjoy it. But sometimes I feel like, oh, that kind of opened up something, that kind of showed me a side of it, like you're saying, Evan, that I hadn't really thought of or considered. Now that I see that that can happen, yeah, maybe I don't like it as much.
Do you think the person taking it more seriously is invoking some sort of performance anxiety in you as a player? Because I definitely felt that before, where it's like I'm sitting down with a bunch of like hardcore Euro players and it's, I just kind of want to push buttons and pull levers and see how many of these little squishy berries I can collect. I did not know you could lap me in this game, but you figured out a way to lap me.
For me, it's not about that. For me, it's just I'm much more interested in seeing the game state develop than I am in winning. So when somebody is super focused on winning, I just have less fun. And I think they probably do too, playing with me, because I'm just like, I don't care. I'll just do whatever sounds neat. You know, maybe like to them, maybe that's like not playing it in the right spirit or something. Mm-hmm. So I think you just have to kind of be aligned on your attitudes. When you play the game, I don't think it's about performance anxiety one way or the other. It's just people play games for different reasons, and you need to be playing with people who play for the same reasons as you to be having the most fun.
I think, like, I don't know if this is tangential or not, but like kind of like time of day or just just the context, really, like how you, like when you land on a game, like if it's before dinner, after dinner, you know, like with certain friends, like I know a lot of times, like at the end of the day is when you have free time, but then you're kind of tired, you're not really ready to like learn new rules or be thinking and doing stuff necessarily, or not everybody. So like, you know, noon on a weekend versus late at night, you know, evening on a weekday, you're going to be in a totally different mindset, mood, vibe, whatever.
Yeah, I find your personal life can really impact that too, as a result of that. Like, especially if you're playing around food, if it's getting later and you just had a big meal, you're probably going to be a little bit sleepy. And so you're not necessarily going to want to hear a lot in a teach. So probably a light card game is the way you want to go if you're going to play something new. Otherwise, it's just going to have to be something you're already familiar with. If you're playing earlier in the day, though, you're usually a bit more awake. So it just kind of makes sense to say, okay, well, it's 1 p.m. Let's do that big new game and we'll save the old classics for later because we have the brain capacity right now, too.
There's definitely some games that in my mind are just like late night getting loony games.
Yeah, 100%.
So like High Society, for example, is one of those. I have had so much fun playing that when we're like so tired that we don't like remember how numbers work. Like if we've gotten to that point pretty much. It's very funny. Because if you're like really, really alert, you can like start counting how much money people have. But like that game is ideal when you can't even possibly imagine how to count how much money people have. You have to be that just like out of it. Art Robbery is another one like that.
Ding and ding.
Which likewise is like so simple, but if you're just like tired and in a very like loony state, it can work well.
Well, that's the whole strength of That's Not a Hat, is the more tired you are and the more people you have that are tired, the better that game is.
Yeah.
I think personal stress can also play a big factor in that. If I'm very tired and stressed out from work, I just want to play like Trick Taker or like a Nana sort of thing where it's, you know, I can just kind of interact with people and just enjoy people. If I'm awake and stressed out from work, I want to play like a heavy Euro because I don't want to think about work. I just want to focus on the game.
Something like a heavy Euro, it kind of gives you like a thing you can control and build and work on versus like a party game that's just kind of about blowing off steam or just kind of like interacting with people or guessing clues or whatever.
Is there anything that's on the line between like a game factor and non-game factor? So for example, how the rules are explained to you? Mm-hmm. Like partially that's the rules themselves, which can be intuitive or not, simple or not, but also whether somebody who's teaching it is teaching it well or whether the rules are written well.
Mm.
Like that to me is like on the line between non-game factor and game factor. So, well, first of all, where does that fall? Is that the game's fault for not being intuitive, or is it the explainer's fault? How much of an effect do these like gray area factors have? Are they more than the non-game factors straight up, or are they less than? Yeah, what do you guys think?
I think it depends on a few things. Like, is this person normally a good rules explainer? And then if it's not a very good rules explanation, is that the game's fault for having poor rules? But I would say by and large, the task of being a rules explainer is challenging because if it's not the best presentation of the rule book, you kind of have to figure out a way of making it presentable to your players at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And so if they're tired or they're having a bad day or their mind just isn't on the teach, it could be the best rule book ever. But if they aren't in the zone, then it's going to fall flat and it could result in stuff, you know, coming up for the first half an hour of the game, which can make it feel like it's dragging out longer than it is. I've definitely had teachers where like the game only took us an hour, but because we were still talking about rules after half an hour, it's like, can this just end? Like, I want out of the driver's seat at this point.
Yeah, I definitely think there's like those games that lend themselves to being easy, you know, like Botswana. Like, I feel like that one's just so easy to explain. It's almost like anybody could probably teach it pretty well, pretty quickly if they knew the game, you know what I mean?
A good example of what I'm talking about is Amun-Re. I was playing that for the first time. For some reason, the table just could not grok the fact that we were going to buy lots for three rounds and then reset everything except for pyramids and stone. So the way that game works is it's split up into two sections or two eras, I guess. And halfway through, everything that you've done gets reset. All your farmers die, all your crops wither, everything goes except for the pyramids and the bricks. And then you re-auction off all those spaces. So the first half of the game, you could have been setting up a nice little strip of pyramids, which Steve then swoops in and purchases. And because no one really quite got it until the game was almost over, there was no real tension in any of the auctions. It was a lot of just like, oh, you want that space? Cool. I'll just go over here. And so it felt very much like the game never really got going. It was just a lot of, oh, I'll just bid for this.
Well, that's another interesting thing. It's like some games have a certain amount of player buy-in that's required. So I think like Quacks of Quedlinburg needs a lot of player buy-in. I think you have to convince yourself that what you buy matters, even though I'm pretty convinced it doesn't matter basically at all. You can buy whatever the heck you want and you'll win or lose based on luck. But if you buy in that it matters, then like, oh, now you're playing the game. Or Libertalia is another one where I think you have to buy in that you're playing all these mind games, but it's just luck. You know, like how could you possibly predict what the person's going to play? I don't know. You may as well just all flip randomly. But for example, in Libertalia, I can buy in. When I'm playing that game, I am so convinced that what I'm doing is like strategic masterminding that like when I pull it off, I'm like, yes, I'm so smart. Or like when you do it, I'm like, oh, you figured me out. But maybe it could have just all been top deck flips and it would have, you know, been the same outcome. I think Raw also needs a lot of buy-in from the players. So
Dang.
if players aren't willing to buy in, and by that I mean like think about the game like they're supposed to, as though their decisions are meaningful. If they're just if they think that it's all luck or it doesn't matter, then they start playing randomly. I for example, played a Hot Lead with a friend who just top decked. They didn't do, they just like shuffled their cards up every round. They just put the top card in. That's how they played. And the rest of us were actually playing. And, you know, I thought it was kind of fun. Some people might have a problem with that and be like, you're not really playing the game. But I was like, oh, that's cool. That's a fun experiment. If he did it every time, I might get bored. But he just felt like doing that and seeing what happened. Because he couldn't buy in to like the strategy of which card you pick.
Two questions for you. How well did that friend do?
He did it twice. So in the first round, he got dead last. In the second round, he was like second and by a very close margin. Because Hot Lead is lucky nonsense. Okay. It's lucky.
I've never played it, so.
It's so lucky. It's complete luck.
Don't all games require some level of buy-in at some point, though? Maybe that's a whole topic unto its own.
That could be a whole topic. But like when you sit down to play a heavy Euro, what are you buying into? Like when I say buy-in, I mean like convincing yourself that the game is deeper or more interesting or more clever than it really is, when it's really just luck. That's kind of what I mean by buy-in. In that sense, which maybe isn't the right word. Maybe there's a better word, like
it'd be more like
self-deception.
Yeah, or suspension of disbelief.
yeah.
From like a filmmaking standpoint. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to think about that now in the context of a Euro. What type of buy-in do you require for that?
I mean, there's also like buying into hope. So I've heard some people say they don't like Rapido / Escape because it's like, oh, it's so swingy, like you can get stuck forever. But the game is set up such that you could theoretically make it from the start to the finish in a single turn.
Yeah.
So like if you buy into the hope that like, oh, there's a chance that I make it back in, the game is way more exciting. Whereas if you're like on the 0th step out of the 20 you need to win and somebody's on the 18th, you could be like, oh, this is stupid, I'm out of it. But you have to like buy into that hope and to that like faith in the dice. So I think it really goes with lucky games. I don't know if this idea applies so much to non-lucky games.
Well, that's the whole thing about shooting the moon, right? Like right back to a formative trick taker. It's I'm doing so poorly, I'm just going to try to absolutely tank my game now and hope that it goes so bad that I actually just wind up winning.
You know, I feel like this is getting off topic, but I feel like having that pointed out sometimes is really big in like in a teach or something, or like if you see somebody kind of like giving up or like being like, well, it doesn't even matter, I'm on step two, you know, kind of pointing that out, be like, well, you could theoretically, you know, roll doubles just until the end, you know, like letting them know that like there is a chance, there is a way out, this isn't like 100% hopeless, because I think sometimes like you just don't see it and then it does feel like, well, I genuinely doesn't matter. Which even then it could be like, well, I could still see how far I could get or whatever. I think sometimes people just like a polite pointing out of, well, you could do this, you know.
I heard a adage which was, take light games seriously and serious games lightly. And I think that's a really great way to approach stuff, or at least kind of based on what we're saying, where if you take a heavy Euro and you treat it as kind of like a silly yakety sax thing, it's a lot of fun. But if you take like a stupid, super lucky game like Rapido and you act like it's the heaviest Vitala Certi game that you own, it's also very fun because like, oh man, I need to roll a 6 and a 7 here.
Yeah, I agree. I love that adage. Yeah, I think that is exactly how I like to enjoy games, for sure. That's a great adage.
And that's why I hate medium weight games, is because I just don't know what to do. Do I take it seriously? Do I take it goofy? I don't know.
We covered this kind of like with the art and stuff, but this just makes me think of, there's a card game called Dobro, and it has really fun, colorful art. And I got this game, wanted to try it out with my buddies, and we were playing, and I was reading the rules. I'm like, oh, darn, this actually seems just very lucky. Like, there's almost zero skill here. I think maybe zero skill here. You know, and I was like reading the rules. I'm like, this is going to suck. This is going to be like just, but then like my friends and I, we all were curious about it. We all liked the art. We all thought it was cool. Like, I feel like we all wanted it to be fun. And so we all were 100% bought in, as Robert would say, like to this game, where we were like playing stuff and it just felt like, oh yeah, I got you. I saw that coming. I had it ready. You know what I mean? Like, it just felt so good when you had the right cards, even though it was almost entirely luck. I mean, And we were even talking about like, no, I think there's a little bit of strategy here. And it's like, I don't know. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But like, we kind of found it, you know, and told ourselves we had it. So I agree with the adage too.
That adage reminds me of a game we played at that game day Steve was talking about with one of his friends, Pastnacht, which is a German designer's take on Uno. And it's actually quite good. It's certainly more strategic than Uno. But not that much. But it was kind of like buying into the seriousness of a light game that made me enjoy it as much as I did, I think. Because I was like, oh, interesting, you played the five, so I can't play the five. A very simple, you know, kind of thought. But just like buying into like, oh, interesting, you did that, which means this. It definitely made that game shine when otherwise maybe if I had a sillier attitude, I'd have been like, yeah, this is basically Uno with more rules.
All right, so for our final ending impromptu, I said we call it the impromptu segment, but like this whole thing is impromptu. None of this is planned, guys. Like,
well, the first time we did this segment, it was impromptu, and so now it's the impromptu segment.
Okay.
We definitely didn't plan the segment the first time we did it.
Fair. For the impromptu segment, we are going to talk about what our ideal gaming environment would be, and what game are we going to be playing in that ideal environment. So I think for me, it would basically be like a, like I would be either hosting or somebody would be hosting. We wouldn't have to be dealing with like a public environment where you're dealing with outside conversations and stuff. I would be able to control the music. You know, we would have snacks, things like that. We wouldn't have to be paying a lot for these snacks, you know? So probably I would just be hosting. My dogs would be behaving. I personally like to add some music to the game. I think it's a lot of fun. I think it adds environment. So assuming that nobody's opposed, I also think I would be with really good friends who are ready to buy into the game. I think that is very important because the game that I probably would be playing is, I still have the Batman, the animated series. There's like a minis game, the Shadow of the Bat. There's a few Batman games, even the animated series ones. So this is one of those games that's just a giant box, tons of minis. Most people don't have any interest in playing this game. And so for me, having a group of friends who would be ready to get into Batman and want to play this game, and we could throw on the soundtrack and be like kind of coming up with the stories and getting into it and almost like role playing a little bit, I think that would just be an absolute blast. But I think it's, unfortunately, I've had the game, I'm even debating selling it just because I've had it for so long, and like that environment just doesn't really pop up very often. So yeah, but if I could wave a magic wand and have my ideal environment, that's what my gut's saying right now.
So mine is, I think, hosting, because I really like to host stuff. The room lighting is at 4,000 degrees Kelvin. The temperature is at 21 degrees Celsius. It's cozy. We got nice ambient lighting. No, none of that direct garbage shining on the board and hitting all that spot UV and making it impossible to read. Just nice ambience. And I think we're playing High Society, to be honest. That game always lands. I have yet to show someone that game and them not go, let's play it again. It's just one of those things where it always gets good reactions. It always gets table talking. It always gets people laughing and making accusations. And it's also a really fun spectator game. So if you have like six or seven people, you can just have two people sit out and watch, deal them in, other people just sit out and watch, and it's still a good time. It's not one of those things where you don't really know what somebody's thinking. It's like watching people play poker. You're just watching everyone bluff each other and try to talk each other into making bad decisions financially, and it's, you can even contribute as a spectator, be like, nah, you got an extra $2. I can see it there. Do it. Come on, spend it. It's such a great time.
Well, the three of us are never going to have our ideal night, because I would also like to be hosting it. So there goes that. It is, let's say, like 10 p.m. We just, you know, like an hour or two ago, we came back from a pretty great dinner with a lot of people. There's like 10 to 12 of us. Let's say like 12 of us. And we are sitting maybe on the floor or on the couch, like slightly uncomfortable, but in a cozy kind of scrappy, you know, making do with what we got way, probably couch/floor, a combination of that. And we're playing Blood on the Clock Tower. And everybody is so bought in. Everybody loves this game as much as I do. And we play for like 5 hours straight.
Whoa.
Just back to back.
That's
to
past
back.
My bedtime.
It's past everyone's bedtime. And every time we finish a round, we're like, one more round. And they're like, yeah, one more round. And we just do another round. And then that keeps happening over and over again.
I actually had that. I had that night once, but it was Secret Hitler.
Okay.
But that was before Blood on the Clock Tower was even out. But I genuinely had that. I had some friends visit. We hosted. We all went out. It was late. We stayed up till like 3 a.m. like just playing it over and over. At one point, our neighbor like had to come down and bang on our door and tell us to shut the heck up because we were just like screaming at each other.
The neighbor's not in my ideal night because I don't do great with confrontation. But besides the neighbor, yes. And also Blood on the Clock Tower. It would be with like friends who I don't get to see that often, maybe. Like maybe friends who live overseas, but I could also be with local friends. But yeah, that'd be the ideal night. Easily. No questions about it. Man, now I want to have that night.
I would love to get together with you guys and some other people that we know and do Cthulhu Wars. Because the way you talk about that game, it sounds like an absolute riot. And then do dinner and then do Blood on the Clock Tower. I think that'd be a riot.
Oh, yeah. Let's do it. I got it. I own it. Let's do it. It's great.
There are a handful of games that I feel like I've heard you guys talk about that I've gone and played. And I'm like, that was fun, but I feel like I want to play it with their group. Like, it sounded like something they had, like they were something about the environment or the people, you know. Curious to see like what it was. Like, was it the way it was taught? Was it the way somebody just got excited? Was it just that, you know, like the way the group kind of gets excitable and it spreads?
I want to do barrel dice with you guys because both of you talk about it so highly, and I have yet to have it not just be like, okay, how many barrels are there now when I've played it? So it's like I want to play with someone that's a human calculator and then the game can just fall away.
Well, I think that's everything. You can always reach us at cardboardphilosophypod@gmail.com. You can listen wherever you're listening to this one, probably, but there's other places if you want to mix it up sometimes. Stuff like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, the Podbean app.
Is the Jazz Trilogy still on Kickstarter when this goes live?
Yes. This goes live, I think, on the 24th, and that's up until the 25th.
Oh, man. Cool. You can get in right under the wire.
So yeah, assuming that everything goes according to plan and this goes live when we think it will, Robert's game should still be on Kickstarter, Shuffle and Swing and Bebop, along with the new refreshed Knizia Cat Blues.
Ding.
Ding. Ding.
All right, that's it.
Play some games.
Buy some games.